Welcome to Mastering Sustainability. I'm Madeline Armstrong, Sustainable Partnerships Manager at Okeanos. I have a master's degree in sustainable business, but as the industry evolves, I'm realizing there's just so much I have to master. Each episode, I'll be joined by Ray Laughlin, our Degradation Innovation Director, who brings years of experience in the science of sustainability. However, despite his extensive knowledge, he still feels like there's so much he has to master in the ever-evolving language of ESG. From carbon reporting to understanding the alphabet soup of the acronyms at the UN, there's so much to learn. If you have concepts you've still yet to master, stick around and we're going to tackle them together with the help of industry experts, academics, and friends alike.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Mastering Sustainability. I am, of course, your co-host, Ray Laughlin, and alongside me, as always, Madeline Armstrong. Hey, Maddie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Ray. How about yourself?
We just wrapped up a really invigorating and interesting podcast with Brad Vogel, coming to us from the Green Sports Alliance. The man has some knowledge when it comes to sporting venues and how to run them sustainably. The timing of this podcast obviously was well planned by producer Nikki to release a sports-based sustainability podcast before the Super Bowl, before we have the Olympics coming up. But we touched on sports across the spectrum. Brad's specialty is here in North America. The Green Sports Alliance is branching out, as he mentioned, into South America and Europe. I think it's paving the way for sustainability all over the place.
What I most liked about the conversation with Brad was he brings a differing perspective, and that is the sustainability aspect of sports and attending sporting games in person.
I cheer for my teams, you cheer for your teams. Neither of us cheer for the sustainability of our teams, but in reality, we probably all should. It's a common goal that is slowly eking its way, at least through sports, and as we'll hear, it's potentially taken bigger strides in other parts of the world. So listeners, for the first half of this podcast, we're going to learn about how hot dogs led to a more environmentally stable sports system, the link between sports industry and sustainability and where there may be flaws, and which leagues are leading the way in fan initiatives and engagement. Take a listen.
Brad Vogel is the Member Services and Event Senior Manager of the Green Sport Alliance. In his role, he works closely with members to ensure that unique needs are met around implementing sustainable programs at sports and entertainment venues, golf courses, production compounds, and the adjacent infrastructure required to host large events. Before joining the Alliance, Bradley was in charge of U.S. Bank Stadium's sustainability program, overseeing the development and implementation of the Waste Diversion Program, energy efficiency capital projects, and the day-to-day policy creation for all lighting at the venue. Working with events like the Super Bowl, NCAA Final Four, the X Games, and events like NFL games, concerts, and more, Brad's time at the stadium peaked with a LEED Platinum certification for operations and maintenance at the first stadium of its kind to receive that distinction. Brad has a robust background with sports and sustainability, supervising waste sorting teams at stadiums like Target Field and Huntington Bank Stadium, to leading green team volunteers at MLB and NHL games. Brad took a brief hiatus from the sports world to work for a Sustainable Investment Group, a full-service sustainable consulting firm specializing in LEED certifications, wellness certifications, and engineering services. In this role, Brad became well-versed in the ARC platform, which is now partnered with the GSA to give leagues, venues, and teams a low-cost option to benchmark, track, and improve their utility usage and waste diversion. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Sports Management from the University of Minnesota and a Master's of Science degree in Sustainable Management from the University of Wisconsin-Stout. Thanks for joining us today, Brad, and welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Madeline. It's great to be here.
Brad, we're going to start you off with the same question we ask everybody from the top of the show. What do you do, and how did you get to the position you're in today?
Yeah, so I work in a niche of sustainability. We sit at the intersection of sports and sustainability in the United States and North America as the Green Sports Alliance. I really got my start when I was in my undergrad degree for sport management at the University of Minnesota, where I had the opportunity to volunteer for the MLB All-Star Green Team when it was here at Target Field where the Minnesota Twins play. That was in my senior year of college, really just piqued my interest into sustainability and sports as a potential route to take within the sports field, because I really didn't know what I wanted to do in the sports world. I knew I grew up loving sports. I grew up in Colorado, so huge snowboarder, huge outdoorsy type person. So really just had that intrinsic connection to nature. And then when I went to school, I was like, all right, this is a good opportunity to go the sports route. And then I had that opportunity to combine them. And fortunately, Target Field up here in Minneapolis, Minnesota was one of the leaders at the time in sports and sustainability. So they had waste sorting going on, which is not very common, almost a decade ago, I suppose now. So I had the opportunity to volunteer for that. And then right as I graduated my undergrad, I decided to go get my master's degree in sustainability management and then really tied those two together. So I did most of my coursework on sports and sustainability as much as I could tailor it. Just really tried to get my foot in the door with any sports team, league, venue, because really the sports industry is weird. You just got to get your foot in the door somewhere and then really just establish yourself. So I started at US Bank Stadium, which is the home of the Minnesota Vikings, not even doing sustainability. It was helping to oversee the tours department, helping with guest experience. So just anything I could really get my hands on. And then met the people who lead the stadium and said, hey, I'm doing this master's degree right now. How can I help? What are you guys currently doing? It was a brand new stadium. Fortunately for me, right place, right time, they had this whole robust sustainability plan and no one really to oversee it.
Wow.
Yeah, it was given to the director of operations and he had a thousand other things he needed to do. Open up a stadium, make sure everything was heated, hot dog going out hot, like everything you could think of to run a stadium. And so it was a very low on the totem pole. So like I said, right place, right time, started with a few small projects. And then just kept working my way up, got promoted a few times and became the sustainability director. So sustainability became my sole role at that stadium. After that, I jumped out of the sports world into the commercial consulting, sustainability consulting world with LEED certifications, things like that. And then the Green Sports Alliance came calling right around COVID, midway through COVID, fun COVID. And now I'm with the Green Sports Alliance and I'm sure we'll get into the Green Sports Alliance. But yeah, that's in a nutshell how I've gotten to where I am now. So it's been an interesting journey.
I love hearing about your journey. What we come across in the industry is sustainability doesn't always have a specific home, right? We know auditing is done by finance, right? It's always done by accounting or the finance team. Sustainability can live in marketing. It can live in operations. And so it's interesting to hear you say that it was the operations director and it was lower on his totem pole and how that even led you into LEED and other sustainability initiatives. Would you say that having your start in sustainability from an operational standpoint led you in the direction of where you've taken your career in sustainability?
Yes, I would definitely say that because it was more building focused, being on the operation side. So it was very waste heavy, energy efficiency heavy, really just energy as a whole, not just electricity. And the stadium was fortunately built to be LEED Gold for building design and construction. So it was already built with sustainability in mind. So when I was writing like my paper, my thesis paper, it was on sustainability at the stadium from the building design and construction phase. So what I was trying to do was how can we take the infrastructure they put in and maximize those efficiencies? So it definitely did really dictate the built environment path I've taken. Then now if we look at sports, it's not just the built environment. There's the whole marketing side, the storytelling, the greenwashing, if you really want to dive into that side. And then the partnership side, like you said, it falls in so many different departments. And my job's funny because I work with, it could be a C-suite person one day, it could be a cleaning person the next day. It doesn't really matter. Everyone has their roles.
So we are definitely going to be talking about the Green Sports Alliance, but you've given us so many things to address here at the start. And I really want to talk a little bit more about your career, but the theme of this show is let's see how many acronyms Ray doesn't know. If anybody has listened through this whole thing. Tell me a little bit about LEED. I need to understand what made the stadium be a LEED certified stadium. I really want to understand where that's coming from.
Yeah, and that's always a running joke with our team as well. Like we're the Green Sports Alliance, so GSA. We work with other organizations like AEG, ASM. And so acronyms are just
acronym like soup.
Oh my gosh, it really is acronym soup. So LEED is a green building certification started by the U.S. Green Building Council, say 25 years ago, give or take. And it's gone through evolutions over the years, but it's a standard for green buildings. There's multiple facets to it. There's the building design and construction side. So when you're actually building a building, and then the operations and maintenance phase of that building. LEED took the code building standards and said, how could we make them more green? And so they'd say, all right, we have our code. Now, how can we make sustainable building standards? And so each iteration of LEED, and they're at LEED V5 right now, so version 5, has gotten more stringent. So a LEED Gold of 20 years ago would be like just LEED certified. And there's different levels of certification. It's based on a point scale of 110. Gotcha. So if you get to 40 points, you're at certified, 50 is silver, 60 is gold, and then 80 is that platinum level. So at US Bank Stadium, what it meant to be and how they got to the point where they decided to go for LEED gold, it really was the municipality who dictated that. So I was very fortunate in terms of being in Minneapolis, very liberal, progressive, very forward thinking when it comes to building, design, and construction. So they had a goal to say, you do need to build it to some level of certification. So I was able to take advantage of a lot of those energy efficiency improvements as we got to the operations and maintenance phase. My role was to really understand how we can make the building as efficient as possible. So working with our ops director, our mechanical supervisor, cleaning team, basically everything across the board, we were able to create a waste policy. So much more hands-on fan focusing, energy policies, which funny enough, even just turning off lights was a policy we had to really implement and hound down with people at that stadium. Very basic things like, hey, is no one in this room? Let's turn the lights off. What a concept. But we were able to achieve more than 10% energy savings, which at a large stadium like that is hundreds of thousands of dollars annually. So that's why LEED certification is very important to us as well, because you are building to be more efficient, but you still need to also maximize the operational side of it.
I want to thank you for giving us a new podcast topic. We need to now go into sustainability of construction and following LEED organizational stuff. And I'm going to have to learn about that at some future episode. From your initial intro of yourself, the main takeaway I took from that was that because of hot dogs' importance, you were able to carve a sustainable role for yourself in a huge organization because it was lower on the priority list compared to hot dogs.
Yeah, no doubt.
I think I have one more question here, because I think what Ray is saying is so important. Like, so many times you go into this field, or if you want to be in sustainability, there's just so many avenues to go down. You don't really know how to choose or where to go or what's next. Your degree path is very similar to a lot of friends that I know. Going into sports management isn't always focused in undergrad around green sports or stadium sustainability. And so I know in my master's degree at University of Miami, we actually had the opportunity to do a green building management course. We got GPRO certified. And that was one of the first steps that would lead you into LEED certification. Are you seeing professionals coming up that are attaining LEED certifications throughout their studies? Is that something that universities are starting to offer now?
Yeah, maybe not necessarily LEED credentials, but there are starting to become like certification programs. We actually are working with one through the University of Florida IFAS program to create a sports sustainability certification path. I believe there is maybe one or two others out there. So to answer your question, yes, there is starting to become more of a deliberate effort to create that route. Because when I was an undergrad, it was one section of one day in one class to talk about energy efficiency, stadium operations, stuff like that. And then when I went to like my master's, it was just everything sustainability. It wasn't sports focused at all. So I had to tie it all together. But yes, I would say there is definitely more. And there's probably some I don't even know about. Every day, there's so many more young professionals who are coming into this world. And it's just amazing to see these just brilliant minded people, way smarter than me in a thousand different ways, have these opportunities that didn't exist 10 years ago. So it has been very interesting to see how it has developed.
The trajectory of this podcast has taken us all over the place. As I mentioned, I think earlier before we started recording, we've done everything from government to lobbying to private business. But that's the thing about sustainability. So much of the idea of sustainability centers around either the business side of things or the regulatory side of things. You're sitting in an industry. So could you talk in some broad terms about how sustainability affects sports? When I watch my favorite teams on TV, where is all of that translating to sustainability?
That's a great, great question. And really, this is how I approach all of my conversations around sports and sustainability. And I start with, sports are inherently unsustainable. It's a nice to have. It's a very superfluous industry. There's lots of travel. There's lots of impact. So how could we take the cultural power of sports? People love sports. It's the most agreed upon thing out there. Most people can't agree on anything. But it's the idea of how can we take the influence sports have and show fans like, hey, can we do the right thing and influence the community? So it's really a community engagement play, as well as a best practices. So watch us do it, learn from us, take it home. So really, it's just that whole nature and culture of sports that we want to take advantage of. Because if we come out there and say, oh, sports are so sustainable, people are going to call you out immediately. These billion-dollar athletes make up such a small portion, but I mean, yeah, they make up 99% of everything, rightly so. I mean, that's why sports exist. But then the ecosystem around it is so large, and that's where it gets a lot more difficult. Stadiums are a opportunity to influence fans hands-on. So when we talk about policies within these stadiums, waste is often one of the most forward-facing. And even if it only makes up a small percentage of your overall carbon footprint, we don't look at it in terms of that because it is that influential ability to say to fans, hey, you can do the right thing. Look at what we're doing here. Take that to your municipality and you're able to create that change. So that's my frame. Sports are not sustainable, but hey, how could we take that power and make it a better community for everybody?
We've beat around the bush long enough. I need to know about the Green Sports Alliance. What are you guys doing? What is your objective? I saw on your website it was since 2010. Tell us about it. What's your target and what are your objectives?
Yeah, so it's a great story, actually. So it was created by pro sports teams. So it was a pro sports industry focus created by sports teams around sustainability. So it started with two distinct groups in the United States. So it was a contingent from the Pacific Northwest. So like Lumen Field, which was, I think at the time, CenturyLink Field. So the Seattle Seahawks, the Mariners, Portland Trailblazers, just that whole Pacific Northwest area. And then it was a little contingent from the Philadelphia Eagles, which, funny enough, someone pointed out that in their supply chain for, I don't know if it was paper towels or something, they found out that they were killing eagle habitats. And being the Philadelphia Eagles, yeah, their owner found out about this and very much was like, what the heck are we doing? And really just took that initiative to say, we need to be better. We can't be killing our mascots, which is just an insane way of like getting into it.
Right?
I was just at a Leaf game in Pittsburgh and was learning all about the Pittsburgh Penguins. We watched a documentary, me and my dad, before I went down. Their first little penguin mascot wasn't the right type of penguin. It was an Antarctica penguin, and they killed it. They gave it hypothermia from bringing it to the ice rink every single day. And it was bigger news in all of Pittsburgh than how the hockey team was doing it. So the Philadelphia Eagles is not alone there.
Okay, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that one. So those two groups decided to get together and hold the first Green Sports Alliance. They created the alliance. That was in Seattle 14 years ago. So we're having our 14th summit this year. So first and foremost, it was the convening of these like-minded sports teams to share best practices, understand challenges, and play a flag in the ground and say, we're starting here. We're going to try to create some standards for green sports and try to build that ecosystem. So we're best known for our annual summit, which is a big convening of these sports leaders, corporate entities. Tons of students come. I actually had my first foray into the Green Sports Alliance volunteering at one of their summits in 2015 when it was in Chicago. So just dove right into it once I heard about it. We're a nonprofit trade organization. So we have our sports membership side of the organization, and then we have our corporate members, which are our solutions partners. So our sports members are made up of 100 plus professional sports teams, leagues. So we work with all the five major leagues at this point. Collegiate entities, we're starting to branch out outside of the United States and North America. So trying to get into Europe, Central America, South America, because there are so many synergies. But what we do is we create playbooks, which are best practice manuals. So we pulled together these leaders. So for example, we just released a playbook last year on building, design, and construction best practices in the sports industry. And it was a light dive into that very niche specific world. We pulled in some of the biggest architects like Populous and McKinstry, who's a mechanical engineering firm, who work on a lot of these major facilities to add their expertise to it. Our board chair, Scott Jenkins at the time, he's not our board chair anymore. He was all over the place. He was with Seattle Mariners. He ended up opening the stadium in Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, which is considered one of the most sustainable stadiums in the world at this point. And they were a LEED Platinum facility for building, design, and construction, which never really happens, especially for a large facility like an NFL facility that has soccer. They were able to do a lot of great things. So he steered the ship to where we are now. He actually just stepped down from his board role last year. And really from a high level, the GSA's role is to expand green sports. So how can we keep pushing the needle forward? How can we highlight the people who are doing things? how can we talk about the challenges that they're having and not just these successes? How can we meet these teams where they're at? Because most of these teams are in municipalities who don't really have the policies like in Minnesota or Pacific Northwest. So we try to help them dive into this world. So how can we help? We'll meet you where you're at. If you need waste help, energy help, we have so many connections. What we're known for is our list of experts in this industry. Yeah. And we want to convene and connect people. That's what the Green Sports Alliance is.
The breadth of the Green Sports Alliance, obviously professional sports teams, you're in the five major leagues. How far down the food chain do we go all the way to like a high school level, collegiate?
Yeah, it's collegiate at this point. We did start to do high school ambassadors, but yeah, just too many kids out there. Too many high schools.
There are a lot of high schools. I do agree with you there. New market for you to one day move into. One of those smart brainy people who is going to be joining your team will be the one to do that, right?
And that's the thing. The impact trickles down. There's so many sports athletes out there at the high school level. Lots of room for impact. Our tagline is playing for the next generation. So everything we do is with that lens of, this is not for the athletes right now. We want to make sure the youths that are coming up through the system have access to sports, because if it gets too hot outside, how are they going to play? Air quality. You can't play in bad air quality. It's not good for you. So
I heard a crazy news story the other day from Jane Fonda that said, we cannot have healthy people on a sick planet. And I think that really plays into sports too, right? When you're expecting people to be at the top of their athleticism, you need to be healthy in order to do this. How can we do that on a dying planet if you want to go that far? We need to create more sustainable systems in order to have people long-term in sports. We need healthy people to have fun, healthy sports.
No doubt. And as you're seeing, sports is not going anywhere. Like the pandemic really put the brakes on it. But since then, you've seen a resurgence where ratings are through the roof. TV deals are through the roof. Sports are not going anywhere. People still want to play sports.
If you had to choose one sport league that's leading the charge in sustainability, is one being a sufficient leader that everyone's mimicking?
I'll give a very broad answer. It's really not the United States. It's European teams. So the Premier League starting to step up. The Dutch League, the Dutch Netherlands League, Ajax Amsterdam is one of the most sustainable stadiums in the world. They can use their battery systems at that stadium to help charge the city. But if I had to look at leagues in the United States, it's sailing leagues, surfing. But then when it comes to the major five, all of them have peaked at different times. And I don't know if they play off each other in that regard, but there's definitely unicorns in each one of those leagues, teams who are just like doing amazing things, and then some not so much. But if you did have to look at it from the lens of how many of these leagues have a designated sustainability person, there's not very many. NHL has a designated person around sustainability. NFL has the Grows, Jack and Susan Grow, who do a lot of their tentpole events. They've been doing it for 25, 30 years. But the rest are all under other kind of areas. So if it's like ballpark operations or if it's NBA, it's social impact. So not to say just because you don't have a designated person doesn't make you a leader. It just does show a little bit extra commitment to the cause.
In the same vein, you may not want to answer this one. Which types of leagues have the furthest to go?
That's a great question. So it's actually the NFL. It's funny because they do a lot for their major tentpole events, but it's the trickle down to the teams that are still lagging. And I think that's because the NFL has been a juggernaut for so long. And they don't have as many games, so I don't think there's that much of a, oh man, they travel as much. They have 18 games. It's not nearly like hockey where you're flying back and forth. So I don't think it's been as prominent for them. And then you got to look at who the owners are of a lot of these teams and venues, and some had some oil ties. So we got to be very cognizant of what that looks like. And that, not to say they've been lagging in like the social impact space, but they definitely did not consider sustainability for quite some time outside of their tentpole events.
Yeah.
So I suppose there's two ways you can look at it, because each league has like their all-star games. NFL's in its own world because their championship is held at a neutral site. So you have a lot more ability to control everything that is going on. So they really put a lot of focus into that as opposed to trickle down to the clubs. And they said to the clubs, you can do it on your own. From top-down leadership, I've known that the NHL and MLB have had top-down kind of mandate, like recommendations and best practices. So there has been different levels of like top-down leadership, but it's all over the place right now.
It's interesting because my first thought would be just stadium size. I read a study the other day, just to throw a little more hurt on the Dallas Cowboy organization, but they were saying that the AT&T Stadium is the largest stadium in the NFL, right? and it can use up to 10 megawatts of electricity on a single game day. And that's enough to power approximately 3,600 homes. That's a lot of energy. So my first thought was always the size of the stadium might contribute to how big of a footprint you have. But it's interesting hearing these other points that go in behind the scenes that might not be the forefront of what people think are the big environmental factors as well.
No, that's a good call out because it really isn't just the venues itself. This is kind of where we're at the industry is like, where do we draw the line with scope 3 tracking for sports? Because it's, do you include fan travel? Do you not include fan travel? So there's a lot of different little nuances to it. But generally what we've seen, it's travel is the biggest emitter because sports teams, they have to travel to these places. Fans have to travel to get to these venues, especially if it's like a collegiate football championship now where we're going to have next year 12 different teams in the playoff, all at neutral sites. So their fans are going to be just going all over. Oh, that's another great example. I'm thinking of like just college realignment where we have two teams on the West Coast are going to be flying all the way to the East Coast now. And so it's just a little like transportation pieces that are just, oh my gosh. But there's not much you can do about that at this point. I mean, you can buy offsets, but that's not a solution. It's a stopgap, as you will. So yeah, it's just a very interesting dynamic.
And there's the buzzer for halftime. Maddie, the time flew by in the first half of this podcast. I didn't want to stop him, honestly, to take this pause.
GSA is such a complex organization having to deal with so many different leagues. No two sports are the same. There's so many unique aspects to that individual league that must not translate, but then there's so many similarities as well. There's a lot to uncover there in that first half.
You can talk about sustainability at a stadium in terms of the food, in terms of the packaging, in terms of transportation, in terms of energy cost, in terms of water, and all of this is covered. All of this has to be analyzed to understand the actual footprint a stadium or a sporting team or an event is putting out there into the world.
And it brings me back to your first statement around this whole podcast and this topic is it's not something that comes to your forefront or your mind. The three of us are big sports fans, but we've never really considered the sustainability aspect of watching or supporting a team. And so when you consider the back house operations that go on behind the scenes, it really does bring a holistic picture of what goes into game day.
And the fact that Brad had the back of house picture going into his role into sustainability, I can only imagine helps him tremendously. Because when he talks about the little things like turning off lights and that sort of thing, he knows how frequently that was done because he was doing it. So putting initiatives as simple as that can make a significant difference. And welcome to the part of the podcast where Maddie and I try not to get fired. Jonas is the creator of Made From Stone, source reduction technology that enables brands and manufacturers to reduce the plastic and CO2 emissions of their products by substituting renewable calcium carbonate. Our goal is to turn off the plastic tap at the source and help bring sustainability to everyone around the world immediately, scalably, and affordably. If you want to learn more about Okeanos, visit our website at madefromstone.com or follow us on Instagram at @wearemadefromstone. Initiatives, not industrial. In the second half of this podcast, listeners, we're going to learn all about the big environmental initiatives that are being implemented for the massive sporting events such as the Super Bowl and the Olympics. What does the most sustainable game day experience look like from someone on the inside? And does the grouping of stadiums and venues into single conglomerates help promote sustainability, or is it hindering it? Take a listen. Welcome back to the conversation we were having with Brad from the Green Sports Alliance. Brad, we were talking about a little bit about the NFL. With the Super Bowl just around the corner, we also have things like the Summer Olympics that are coming up. I want to get someone from the inside's perspective on what are these big events doing right in terms of sustainability?
Yeah, definitely. One thing I've always loved that the NFL and the Super Bowl has done, and this is what the Groves, Jack and Susan Groh, really have created throughout the 25 plus years they've been doing it. It's called Super Kids, Super Sharing Program, where they go into each one of these cities, these towns, wherever the Super Bowl is being hosted, and they create like a big convening of all the schools. So it could be elementary, middle school, and it's about sharing equipment, sports equipment, books, things like that. So it's from maybe more affluent neighborhoods to how can they get people to donate to students and kids who maybe don't have the same opportunities. So that's something they've been doing year in and year out. And those are the types of community impact sustainability that I just love. Because when it comes to sustainability, if you have your on-venue site, very much game day, and then it's like, what is the ancillary? What can you actually do outside of that controlled space? So it's been amazing to see them really take outside of the actual stadium and really create a program like that. And then they do also things like, I want to say in last year in Arizona, they did like a river restoration project a few years back when it was in Miami, and they did some coral reef restoration. So a lot of very community-focused events, because when they do go to a lot of these Super Bowl venues, a lot of the infrastructure on site depends on what the stadium is doing. So when the Super Bowl was hosted up here at US Bank Stadium, we already had waste programs in place, things like that. So they were able to take advantage of what we were doing at the stadium, but really it's their community impact side. It's funny that you mentioned the Olympics, and FIFA comes to mind as well, because we have the World Cup coming up in 2026. Both those organizations, it's a very unique world because it's governing bodies for hundreds of countries. It's a lot of different stakeholders, a lot of different opinions. And they talk a lot. They talk a lot of big talk. You know, FIFA talks about sustainability. Yes. And I work with FIFA, so I see it. They do care. Like, the people we work with in their sustainability world do care. But then it's like their leadership on the other side awards, you know, a World Cup to Qatar. And then it's just like, holy cow. So they'll say the right thing and then their actions show something else. But the Olympics as a whole, I will give them some credit. They have gotten better over the years. And it started in London in the 2012 Olympics, where they created a whole standard around sustainable event certification called the ISO 2012 One Standards. And that framework is starting to become embraced internationally as the actual event frameworks certification. So not so much building design and construction and building specific, but the actual pieces around the event. So the Olympics created that standard. You could say they maybe took this few steps back with going to Russia, but the great piece of the LA bid, and I remember seeing this at a summit years ago when they first started bidding for the Olympics, their bid was based off of reusing a lot of the venues that were used for the Olympics that previously had been held in LA. So the nature of what they're trying to do is very much, how can we reuse the Coliseum? How can we reuse these venues that have already been built for these exact purposes again? And that's where the industry is going. So the Olympics are getting a little bit more cognizant of, like, they're going to be in Paris this summer. So how can we go to places that have this infrastructure and not go to these places that have nothing at all, Qatar and FIFA, and build 16 new stadiums out of the blue that need to be air conditioned in winter? Anyway, yeah, I digress.
Yeah, when you tell me, and I'm glad to hear the Olympics is doing this vision to try and reuse, and hopefully that catches on. But then you look at a organization like FIFA, who is going to turn around and say, no, you need to build 16 new stadiums for us to even consider you. That's, I think there's some catch up room FIFA can implement, or at least some more priority on the sustainability side when making decisions overall. But that's some really interesting insight into those organizational protocols. And I'm really glad I never knew.
Yeah. And to give purpose, right, to these buildings after these games, because that was one of our questions we were going to ask, is what do you do with these buildings after? And so they need to have a purpose. So many times they go unused and then they're just a waste of space, and that is no good for the city or the team. So when we're talking about an Olympic game or a stadium, when we go into the stadium, talk us through what the most sustainable game day experience could look like, from waste management to the back of house operations. What does it look like when we go into a stadium?
So I'll start on the waste side, because that's when you're walking into a stadium, that's what you're going to see 99% of the time. When you walk in, all the lights will be on. That's part of the guest experience. So there is the idea of fans come first. So the fan experience is paramount when it comes to these stadiums. When it comes to these programs, it's trying to make it as seamless as possible, where the fans don't even have to notice sometimes. Really, the main trends in the waste field right now are compostables. So if you have food waste donation, if you can actually get compostable vessels that you can put your food in, throw it all into one bin. But that's so dependent on local infrastructure, where we have teams buying compostable products, not even realizing, like, hey, there's nowhere to put it in the municipalities. It's a very difficult one, because when we do introduce compostable products, it has to be so clean. There can't be any contamination in the waste stream. So then what that means for these stadiums is they have to do either a waste sort after the fact, or create systems that are so foolproof that fans just put it in the right thing, which we haven't seen yet. So what that means is it's very much back to house. And when we mean back to house, it's not fan facing, waste sorting. Right now, we are seeing a renaissance with reuse in this industry. The Moda Center, which is where the Portland Trailblazers play, they're the first arena in the United States to fully implement reusable cups. So it's going to be a very interesting case study. And we actually are pulling them into our playbook we're doing this year on reuse to get their insight of like, hey, what were your challenges? Things like that. So from that side, their fans are coming. They have very much a clear designated reuse bins on their cups. It has like a QR code says, hey, please put me in this reuse bin. And what we're seeing with that as well is it's a fan engagement aspect. So you can get people scanning their cup, entering them in for, I don't know, some giveaway or something. So it's getting people to really think about, oh, wow, this is cool. We're actually reusing this cup. Lots of different opinions out there, actually, of what's the most sustainable route. Is it aluminum cups? Is it compostable cups? I don't think there's a right answer at this point. It really depends on where you're at in the United States or North America and what your infrastructure looks like. But from the waste side, that's really, I would say, the best I've seen is really ones who are able to make it as simple as possible for the fans. So one thing I always say is if you eat from it, make it compostable. If you drink from it, make it recyclable. So then you can say that exactly to the fans. Like, drink, recycling, eat, compost, and then just source all of your products coming into the stadium that fit those kind of streams. Best teams who are doing that, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, they do a full-on robust waste sort, which is just unreal. Waste sorts at stadiums are just disgusting, but they're very needed. So, but from that angle, we just talked waste. So when it comes to more sustainable things, it'd be all back of house. So maybe you have renewable energy coming on site. Maybe you have hydrogen systems on site. Maybe you're enrolled in a demand response program with your local municipality. So a lot of things fans will not see. And then from the water side, we haven't even really touched water, I would say, at all. Those are just like installing low flow fixtures, making sure you have the most efficient fixtures available for the needs of a stadium where you have thousands of people flushing the same toilet over and over. And then water reclamation. Does your stadium have a water reclamation system that you can use for irrigation if it's an outdoor stadium, or irrigation for your field or your exterior landscaping? And then transportation is the other one that really is at the forefront of when you come to a facility, what you will notice. Is there light rail that can take you to the stadium? What does the public transit look like? Is it just a sea of parking lots around the venue? So all those different considerations really come to mind when you look at sustainable stadiums, where the best ones have public infrastructure like light rail built into that system. Minneapolis and US Bank Stadium, great example. They have two light rail lines that converge right at the stadium. Same with Atlanta. So like tons of different ways you could look at it. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I'm so happy that Green Sports Alliance allowed you to come onto this podcast because we're talking to the right person. Ed, you're boiling it down to the fan experience, because me being in the field of sustainable plastics for the past 15 years, it more or less comes down to changing consumer habits. And that is one of the most difficult things that I think you can do on a large scale. So to hear you telling techniques that these stadiums are implementing, simplifying the messaging going to fans, it has broader reach and the impact that you can have, because that doesn't stay in that stadium when you walk out those gates. That message carries with you all the way to your home.
Yeah. And the best way to do it is without them even noticing. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, talk about consumer incentives. Like, think about how sports and sports betting have evolved, and all the, if you put down $100, we'll match you $100. There's so much unconscious incentive to get people into that kind of thing. There's the same type of initiatives that could be taken with sports sustainability, whether that be a reusable cup program, right? And scanning the QR code that you met and making a $50 win. There's so many opportunities to engage fans and have them learn more about their impacts without realizing.
You know, this is going to be a little bit of a diatribe, and I'm apologizing ahead of time to both listener and you, Brad. We, as a company at Okeanos, targeted stadiums as potentially one of those really nice partners. But one of the huge visions, and I don't know, maybe I'm going to get in trouble for sharing this too early. Some investors are going to yell at me here later. But we see a stadium as almost a perfect closed loop in the world of waste. Because everything, for the most part, is encapsulated between that dome or those walls that circle around the stadium. And with a made from stone, we're putting high levels of calcium carbonate into plastic products to A, reduce the carbon footprint of that product, B, reduce the impact of plastics on our whole environment. But C, one of the coolest things that we might be able to do if we can get into a closed loop system of somewhere, say a stadium, is recollecting all the made from stone products means that we can potentially reconstitute that into concrete that could be used for that local municipality to be used to make multiple things around the area. And when you can reconstitute that material into a building, a road, a playground, whatever it may be, you're ensuring sustainability for a plastic product for the rest of our lifetime. And I'm super thrilled to hear how the waste management system is already now catching up in all of these different places. And the Mercedes-Benz Stadium is doing it hands down the best, because now that gives me, as someone in sales that's doing this, a targeted idea of where I can take this idea where they already have infrastructure for sorting. And if we could do this on this big, broad scale, we could make not just recyclability of a bottle a thing, but everything else that comes with the package of all those chips that could be packaged in a made from stone chip product could now be turned into concrete and ensure sustainability across the board. Closed loop economies for sustainability are so rare in today's world. And this goes back again to consumers and fans having to change habits, because it is so difficult to make consumers think, oh, I need to take this one item and dispose of it in a proper receptacle for it to be a closed loop economy. And you have to do that millions and million times over to every household to actually have some form of an impact. But versus a stadium, I'm going to put 47, 75,000 people in to watch a game of some sort, and then they're all going to walk away, but they don't want to carry all that stuff they bought in the stadium with them. That's the rarity of this. Go ahead, Maddie.
And essentially, Ray, what you're saying is it's EPR, right? Extended producer responsibility, and then these closed loops. And I think this is one of the most highly greenwashed areas. And I don't think it's done intentionally. I think it's done with good intention. It's just that a lot of these materials are not meant to go through a second life cycle. Plastic is very hard to recycle and have the same properties come out for a second life. And so one of the things that always irk me is when I see, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, you mentioned, is compostable cups or compostable products. We'll see it in stadiums in Miami, and you're like, there's no composting facilities in Miami. Why are we having compostable products? Why are these companies paying this extreme upmarket to have these products just for the branding of it, essentially, is what it is. It's a feel good at that point because there's no composting. So it's going to landfill and it's doing worse because it's releasing methane or whatever. This is a highly greenwashed area. And I think sports stadiums, you see this highly concentrated amount of people in the same area consuming these products. There's a lot of room for change there. And I think, Ray, looping back to Made from Stone, that's a big reason of why we're trying to do these closed loop systems with a degree of efficiency that I don't know has been done before.
Absolutely. Getting back to the topic that we have you here for, Brad.
Before we go off on a tangent.
You know, I was one of these fans. I'm a Buffalo Bills fan. I grew up in Blacksburg, Virginia, so I'm a Virginia Tech Hokies fan. I always thought to myself, oh, these teams pay for the stadium. They own the stadium. But I have now realized, because of my dealings in the sustainable world, that many of these stadiums aren't owned by just one. They're owned by a parent group. And you have 10, 15 stadiums or venues that are all owned by one single group.
Yep.
In your opinion, does sustainability start to climb the ladder of importance when you start conglomerating all of these into one entity? Or does it stay below hot dogs in terms of the importance for all of these stadiums as a whole?
Yes. No, it's definitely helping. And we have a lot of good examples we can point to within that world. I've worked for a few different building management companies. One was ASM Global, who oversees six NFL facilities and 100 convention centers, so right up that alley. But what they were able to do is create standardized policies across all of their platforms and leverage those policies to work with partners. So if it's like a concessionaire, they're able to say, hey, how can we work together? Because we have this many venues. How can we get better deals for compostable products or something like that? So you can be a little bit more ahead of the curve leveraging. And then there's newer kind of groups out there like OBG, Oakview Group, who they're newer to the space, but they call themselves a disruptor within this world where they are really prioritizing sustainability within their portfolio, which is causing a lot of these other building management companies to do the same. And then lastly, AEG, so many acronyms. This is so
I'm loving it. No, keep going. I'm adding it to my little notebook here.
No, and then AEG used to own a lot more venues, but they actually sold off a lot of their properties to ASM Global again. But they actually have a huge sustainability program where they work with Crypto.com Arena, which used to be the Staples Center. So one of the most heavily utilized arenas in the country, but they have a few other properties as well. But they have been doing the same thing as being able to leverage those additional events. And they do a lot more music events as well, which could be a whole nother topic within itself, because there's a lot of artists out there who are really embracing sustainability and really driving that industry a lot faster than the sports industry. So yeah, I would say it definitely has helped a lot because it creates like that unified strategy. Saying that though, there are a ton of one-off individual teams who own their own stadium, own their own venue. And for them, it's really a coin toss. Is it the municipality dictating it? Is it the ownership group who's like, yeah, let's do this?
So teams that don't necessarily own their stadium on the flip end here or play in a stadium that's not themselves. We see the Miami Hurricanes play in the Dolphins and the Hard Rock Stadium, right? How do they have control or do they have any control over the sustainable efforts that go into their stadium?
It's hard because it depends on the leverage. So if it's they're the primary tenant, they have a lot more say. If it is something where it is like, hey, maybe you have an NHL team, an NBA team, and an indoor lacrosse team, it gets a lot more difficult. But that's actually ties into those building management companies because they can push that issue. But sports teams, when it comes to on-site stuff, they can do recommendations. I mean, like I said, they have the leveraging power. They're the ones who hold all the cards. The sports franchises hold all the cards. The stadiums are just stadiums. So if they really came in and said, hey, we want to do X, Y, Z, of course, the stadium operators say, well, I mean, how are we going to pay for it? But they will do. So sports teams have a lot of say when it comes to those things. Will they do it though? Not really, because let's just say NFL. A lot of them don't own their own stadiums because they don't use them that often. And you have 10 home games a year at a minimum. If you're a Bills fan, you have the playoffs. So good for you, Greg.
That well of hope, I'm still sipping from it. But by the time this comes out, I'll know whether or not I'm really sad or still happy.
Yeah, or you could be celebrating a Super Bowl championship. You never know. So
I never know.
Knock on wood.
But like on that same breath, like a lot of these NFL teams have very huge training facilities, social impact programs, community impact programs. So they put their efforts into other areas. So maybe not as much stadium focus, but more community impact. And then and MLB is, it's funny because NFL and MLB are completely opposite, where it seems like MLB, most of them own their own stadiums. And that's just because
they're in it for three quarters of a year. Yeah,
exactly. And it's literally only used for baseball. You can't really, I mean, yes, you can put a football field in there, but it's funny that it's really league dependent as well. Because the stadiums for MLB are way more cognizant of what they can do on site because people are there, like you said, 100 days out of the year. So
speaking about like the Miami Hurricanes, which as a Virginia Tech fan, I'm not a big fan of. But anyway, going into like colleges and college venues, generalizing big time here, we're talking probably a more liberal demographic going into it, younger, obviously. Are you seeing sustainability on the college athletics front?
Yes.
Making moves?
Yeah, we definitely are. We actually have another person on our team who's like our collegiate guru. She was part of the team who just released the first sports athletics program sustainability standards with Texas A&M. And they were the first to really come out with the athletic facility standards. And so there are a few that are getting there. But really, it's funny because all of them have a sustainability department outside of athletics. Athletics are their own different world. So right now, the biggest issue we're having is how can we bridge that gap? And yes, there are a few teams who are doing a great job. Texas A&M, Ohio State, off the top of their head, those two are just amazing. USC as well. But the rest of them are like, they have a lot of passionate, young, driven people in these sustainability departments, even athletes, a lot of student athletes. And that's really where we're trying to find the most impact is like, how can we leverage student athletes to create more athletic department change. And then when it comes to the stadium side of universities, those are in their own like little world sometimes. They almost have nothing to do with the actual university. So it's a very weird question because a lot of these universities are doing a lot of great things with their campus, but then the athletics departments are just in their own little world of tons of millions of TV dollars and NIL deals and stuff like that. So yes, there are some doing very good, but there's a lot of room to go.
Yeah, I mean, priorities for, I think, some of the athletics department sometimes is the biggest moneymaker in a university setting. So sometimes their priorities may not align with the rest of a university setup because they're still seen as a cash cow in some way, yes, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. Championships in college in the NCAA rotate the way that, say, the NFL, where the Super Bowl is held. So having a more sustainable stadium isn't an incentive or, you know, plays into a contributive factor of where a championship would be held in college sports. But it does open up a lot of interesting windows of what we're talking about, right? Of developing more programs that have courses in sustainability and developing that connection and having those student athletes getting to participate in their own stadiums and the development of those programs that they play in.
When we talk about something like baseball, let's go back to the MLB as a quick example. Fenway Park, built in 1912. It's essentially a relic, a monument to its time. People go there for the ambiance of seeing the greats that played in that same stadium as the current team is now. How difficult is it for a place like that to start trying to twist that sustainability key? Because it feels like you can't change too much. Otherwise, the fan experience, as you keep alluding to, is built around the history of this. Yet at the same time, we still want sustainability out of our favorite things, our franchises.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. And it's funny because I think of Fenway Park too. It's funny because since they've been around for so long, they have their building maintenance side of things down pat. So like they understand the building so well. So when it comes to energy efficiency, they actually are pretty like decent because they've throughout the years have done so many retrofits. And it's like the ones that are like 30 years old and 30 to 50 that are really seeing the most issues right now around waste. And I would say Red Sox and Cubs are not a great example because they are so well to do that. For example, the Cubs have money to build the whole building right next to their stadium. So they're able to work around that. Not saying every team has that ability, but it definitely gets more difficult with older buildings. But like those two, I would say, are in their own unicorn world where they're like almost historical artifacts where they take more time to make it a better place, more so than like a 30-year-old arena where they're like, well, okay, what's the better option? Just tear it down, restart. But then we get into the whole fan engagement piece nowadays where you're fighting for these fan dollars. So it's like, how can we make the experience on site super beneficial? So when you go to a Fenway Park or whatever the older stadiums are, it's the historical lore is part of that fan experience. So they can get away almost with not having as much updated modern amenities. So it's a very interesting dynamic when it comes to these 30-year-old stadiums and arenas where it's like, yeah, well, we don't want to retrofit because we've got to make it all cool with these bars that are like halfway across the stadium size with 400 suites. And so that's just the owners thinking money. But so, you know, all great questions. And one thing we've actually found is, and I won't name which league, but they started tracking a lot of their energy use. And they said a lot of newer stadiums, even though they're more energy efficient, are using more energy now. And that's just because there's a lot more going on in them. So even if you're building a new state or arena, that's more energy efficient maybe per person, but you're having a lot more going on.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point because I imagine something like Fenway, they thought one light bulb for every 20 feet was enough versus a new stadium. They say, we need 10 light bulbs for every 20 feet. I'm using high efficiency bulbs and fixtures, but I also put in 10 times the amount of light consumption potential.
But yeah, TVs alone. You have thousands of TVs in these venues now all of a sudden. It's just like they all need to be going during these games. And
we hear about some of these older parks like Fenway and how efficient they are. When it does come down to a team trying to retire a stadium, whether it's because the building is outdated. I know here up in Canada, the Montreal Olympic Stadium, which is interesting, right? Back to the Olympic times, it wasn't maintained well. It's falling apart. They use it for the Toronto Blue Jays to do some exhibition preseason games until I think a few years ago, the roof started to fall apart mid-game and it became a hazard. Now they're talking about moving Tampa Bay back to Montreal and now they need to create a new stadium in the future. How does a team go about retiring a stadium and making sure it doesn't become a hazard to the community? Is there a certain type of criteria they have to follow in order for that building to retire gracefully or find a second life?
Yes. When it comes to how you want to take the stadium and what you want to do with it, a few examples I can think of is where they tore it down and then built it back in the same place. But really, those best practices come down to one, from the fans' engagement side. What can you sell the fans as memorabilia? Or not even sell, just give away. Because fans love that stuff. They want to get their own seat from the stadium. So I would always start with that route, saying, what can we donate? What can we give to the fans? And then from there, there's standards for like building design or demolition and construction, where when you are tearing these buildings down, if that's the route they choose to take, where you do separate concrete from steel. And so there are ways to manage those demolitions in a very responsible, sustainable way. And the demolition side is actually very efficient. When you're actually pulling apart that quantity of concrete, steel, you can get a lot salvaged. But when it comes to repurposing stadiums, really one thing I'd love to see is just more of a long-term view when these teams are building these stadiums, because some take that longer-term view. Some ownership groups, maybe not so much. If it is a third-party group, like, I mean, if it's owned by the city, did the city have a plan for it if a team moves? Oftentimes, no. So it's very much just like Oakland, like I'm thinking of the Oakland A's now. Yeah. We're moving to Vegas. And then I guess the Golden State Warriors moved to their new stadium. So there's two vacant facilities now. I wish I could say there's better processes for repurposing those stadiums.
Brad, you've been super generous with the amount of time you've given us. I can't even believe that the time has gone. There's no one aspect that you can point at sports and say, hey, that should be sustainable. Everything has to be sustainable. And it felt like we touched on just about everything in some way, shape, or form. So we're going to get you out of here with a few quick hits. First question I got to ask, and I can't believe I didn't do it from the start. Who are you a fan of? What teams are you out there supporting?
Well, it's funny. I live in Minnesota, but I'm a Denver sports fan. Grew up in Denver, so Denver Broncos, Colorado Rockies, the Nuggets, Avalanche, who have been very good the last few years. I'm a huge soccer fan as well, so I actually do love FC Bayern Munich from Munich, Germany.
And then your profile online, one of the number one things I saw right out the bat was a craft beer lover. So give us a recommendation or two. If you got to sit down for a brew, what are you getting?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you're in the Twin Cities area, you can go to a place called Indeed, which is the same name as the website you find jobs at. They have some of the coolest artwork in their brewery and just some of the most delicious beers you will ever have. So Indeed, if you're listening, hook me up.
Yeah, hook Brad up with some beers.
Brad, one of the questions we always ask our guests is, where do you get your news from? If you were to advise listeners where to subscribe to, whether that be social media, online, newsletters, what type of news are you subscribed to?
Yeah, so we have our own GSA newsletter, greensportsalliance.org, if you want to go and subscribe. I'm on LinkedIn, so if you want to find me on LinkedIn, you can find our GSA page on there as well. We have an Instagram. We have all the social media networks, you know, like the cool young kids do nowadays. And then outside of that, there's two different organizations, like the Sustainable Sports Blog. Then the Sustainability Report is another sports-centric reporting tool out there. But yeah, so it's our newsletter and then those two. And I would say they're all very good at this point. Really, I get a lot of my information from the teams and venues themselves, calling them up saying, hey, what are you doing? How is this working?
Brad, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here. We thank you. We thank the Green Sports Alliance for allowing you the time to come on this. I've enjoyed every second of this. In all honesty, if I ever make it up to Minneapolis for some work, I'm definitely calling you up and we're meeting up in Indeed and sharing a beer together.
Sweet. That sounds like a plan. And thanks for having me. It's been a great experience. And hopefully everyone is listening can learn a little bit and reach out if you have questions. We're always happy to chat sustainability.
Awesome.
We'll definitely put all of your links in the bio of this episode. And it was wonderful to have you on. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
Take care. And there's the final bell. Maddie, the podcast we just shot, I think, is probably one of my favorite ones so far. It felt like we could ask him about any aspect of sports, and we were going to get a comprehensive answer. Everything that he told us was digestible, at least to me.
He covered a lot of ground. And going into the back house of all the different operational aspects of a stadium was refreshing to hear as a sports fan.
I thought it was a home run. And you're lucky that it took this long to get the first dad joke out of me about a sports thing. When he dives into a topic, he breaks it down in a way that you can digest. And that's saying something for me. And then beyond that, he gives you real-world examples that doesn't feel like they're unattainable. Changing the faucets in every bathroom in a stadium, yes, that is going to probably take time and effort and some cost to it, no doubt. At the same time, everyone who walks into a stadium probably uses one of those faucets. So you can understand why limiting the amount of water loss through new faucets might be a positive, or the amount of energy that's being used, or where that energy is coming from. All of these questions are things that we as sports fans are never going to ask ourselves about, but in reality, they make a huge difference.
Companies have a hard time minimizing their emissions 10%. And it seems like in stadiums, it can be the opposite step, that those small changes can often make the big emission or impact reductions.
Yeah, I mean, you're essentially flying a small town every time a football team has to fly across the country to play a game. So the emissions is going to be there regardless. Mm-hmm. But can we offset as much as we can other aspects, other ways? Green Sports Alliance and their group of individuals and organizations who are part of that seem to be working towards that type of future. My biggest takeaway, honestly, was at the end of our conversation there where we started talking about fan engagement and how his team, the Sports Alliance, are working to make sustainability simple. Bring fans into the conversation through easy monikers, easy ways to help, to the point where fans don't even know they're engaging with it. And I allude to this all the time. If you've heard me on this podcast so far, you've heard how I very much think consumer behavior is one of those things that's the hardest to change. Not saying it can't change, but it's one of the hardest things to change. And when you put a collective of people into a stadium type environment and are able to engage with them on a way that makes them become part of the experience, it's really powerful. And they can walk away from a sporting event after 2, 3, 4 hours there and have something that actually may stick with them to change their behavior for the rest of their life.
Consumer education and being able to do it without the consumer feeling like they're being educated is a tricky but really well thought out of in the sports industry. You can take that and apply that to your everyday life.
Well, listeners, we really appreciate you playing ball to the end of this podcast and joining us on this discussion with Brad all about sports and sustainability. We hope you'll engage with us on social media. Let us know what you think. Please leave us that 5-star review on your podcast app of choice. And tune in next month to continue mastering sustainability right alongside us. Take care.